You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner in four parts, entitled Harmony of the Creative Word, the Human Being and the Elemental, Animal, Plant, and Mineral Kingdoms, formerly known as Man as Symphony of the Creative Word, Collected Works, Volume 230, Revised Translation by Matthew Barton. This is the last lecture, number 3, of the first part. And the first part of the cycle is called Man's Connection with the Cosmos, the Earth, and the Animal World. And this is Lecture 3, given on the 21st of October, 1923. We have tried again from a particular aspect to place the human being into the universe. Today we wish to put the subject forward in a way which will weld everything into a whole. During our physical life, we live on the earth. We are surrounded by events and facts which are there because of the physical matter of the earth. This matter is molded and shaped in the most varied manner to create everything that exists in the kingdoms of nature, and also the human form itself. The physical matter of the earth is part of everything that exists on earth. Today, because we shall immediately have to speak about its opposite, let us call this matter the physical substance of the earth, comprising all that provides the material basis for the various earthly forms. And then, let us differentiate from it everything in the universe which is the opposite of physical substance, namely, spiritual substance. This last is the basis not only of our own soul, but also of all those configurations in the universe which, as spiritual configurations, are connected with physical configurations. It is not right to speak only of physical matter or physical substance. Think only of the fact that we needed to place into our total picture of the world the beings of the higher hierarchies. These beings of the higher hierarchies have no earthly substance, no physical substance, in what might be called their, in quotes, body. What they have is spiritual substance. When we look upon what is earthly, we become aware of physical substance. When we look upon what is beyond the earthly, we become aware of spiritual substance. Today people know little of spiritual substance. That is why they speak of the earth being who belongs in both the physical and the spiritual world, the human being, as though he too only possessed physical substance. This, however, is not the case. Man bears both spiritual and physical substance in himself in so remarkable a way as to astonish anyone who is not accustomed to pay heed to such matters. If, for example, we consider the element in human beings that leads them into movement, namely what is connected with the human limb system and its inward continuation, which is metabolic activity, it is incorrect to speak primarily of physical substance. You will soon see this more clearly. We only speak correctly about the human being when we regard the so-called lower part of human nature as having its basis in fact in spiritual substance. So that if we were to represent the human being in a diagram, we would have to say the lower man actually shows us a formation in spiritual substance. And the further toward the human head we go, the more the human being is made of physical substance. The head is essentially made of physical substance. But of the legs, grotesque though this may sound, it must be said that essentially they are made of spiritual substance. So that as we approach the head, we must draw the human being in such a way that we allow spiritual substance to change gradually into physical substance. Physical substance is to be found particularly in the human head. Spiritual substance, on the other hand, is spread out in a particularly beautiful way just where if I may put it so, man extends his legs and arms into space. It is really as though the most important matter for arm and leg is precisely the fact that they are filled with spiritual substance, as if this is their essence. In the case of arm and leg, it is really as though the physical substance were only floating in spiritual substance, whereas the head presents a compact form composed of physical substance. In a form such as man possesses, however, we must differentiate not only the substance, but also the forces. And here again we must distinguish between spiritual forces and earthly physical forces. In the case of these forces, things are exactly the opposite. In the limbs and metabolism, the substance is spiritual, but the forces are physical. For instance, the force of gravity in the legs. In the head, the substance is physical, but the forces active within it are spiritual. Spiritual forces play through the head. Physical forces play through the spiritual substance of the limbs and metabolism. The human being can only be fully understood when we distinguish in him the upper region, his head, and also the upper part of the chest, as actual physical substance worked through by spiritual forces, the lowest of which, one can say, are active in the breathing. And we must regard the lower part of man as a formation composed of spiritual substance within which physical forces are working. Only we must be clear as to how these things are interrelated in man. For the human being also projects his head nature into his whole organism, so that the head, which is what it is, because it is composed of physical substance worked through by spiritual forces, also projects its entire nature into the lower part of the human being. And what man is, because of his spiritual substance in which physical forces are at work, this, on the other hand, plays upward into the upper part of the organism. In these activities, in the human being, there is mutual interaction. Man can, in fact, only be understood when he is regarded in this way, as composed of physical and spiritual substantiality and of physical and spiritual dynamic forces. This is something of great significance. For if we look away from external phenomena and enter into man's inner nature, it becomes clear to us that disturbance and irregularity ought not to enter into this distribution of substance and of forces in the human being. If, for example, one should be pure substance, pure spiritual substance in man. Let me read that again. If, for example, what should be pure substance, pure spiritual substance in man, is too strongly penetrated by physical matter, by physical substance, if, that is to say, physical substance, which should in fact tend upward toward the head, makes itself too strongly felt in the metabolism, so that the head nature enters too powerfully into the metabolism, the human being becomes ill. Certain quite definite types of illness then arise. And the task of healing consists in paralyzing and driving out this physical substance formation intruding into spiritual substantiality. On the other hand, if man's metabolic system, with its particular and special manner of being, worked through by physical forces in spiritual substance, is sent up toward the head, then the head is, as it were, too strongly spiritualized, and excessive spiritualization of the head results. This also represents a condition of illness, and care must then be taken to send enough physical forces of nutrition to the head, and in a way which does not allow them to become spiritualized. Anyone who turns his attention to human beings in health and sickness will very soon be able to perceive the usefulness of this differentiation, if he is really concerned with truth and not with outer appearance. But something of a very different nature also comes into this. What human beings feel themselves to be, because they are constituted in the way I have described, initially remains below in the subconscious for ordinary consciousness today. It does exist there, certainly as a kind of mood, a kind of life mood, but it is spiritual vision alone that brings it to full consciousness. And I can only describe this spiritual vision to you as follows. Anyone who through modern initiation science knows this secret of the human being, that it is actually the head which is the main, the most essential organ needing physical substance, that it is head in order that it may work spiritual forces into that substance. Anyone who also knows that the most essential thing in the system of limbs and metabolism is spiritual substance, and that this needs physical forces, the forces of gravity, of balance, and the other physical forces, in order to exist. Anyone who can thus penetrate this secret of the human being with spiritual vision, and who then turns his gaze back to human, earthly existence, must acknowledge his tremendous debt to the world. For he must admit that in order to maintain his human existence, he requires certain conditions, and that through these very conditions, he owes a debt to the earth. He is continuously withdrawing something from the earth. And he finds himself obliged to say that the spiritual substance which he bears within himself as man during earthly existence is actually needed by the earth. When man passes through death, he should in fact leave this spiritual substance behind him for the earth. For the earth continually needs spiritual substance for its renewal. But this man cannot do, for he would then be unable to undertake the path he travels as human being through the period after death. He must take this spiritual substance with him for the life between death and a new birth. He needs it, for he would disappear, so to speak, after death, if he did not take this spiritual substance with him. Only by taking the spiritual substance of his limbs and metabolism through the gate of death can man undergo the transformations he needs to undergo. He would be unable to descend to future incarnations if he were to give back to the earth the spiritual substance which he owes to it. This he cannot do. He remains a debtor. And that is something which there is no means of bettering as long as the earth remains in its middle period. At the end of earth existence, things will be otherwise. It is indeed the case, my dear friends, that one who beholds life with spiritual vision has not only the sufferings and sorrows, perhaps also the happiness and joy that are offered by ordinary life. The beholding of the spiritual beings, cosmic feelings, cosmic sufferings and joys. And initiation is inseparable from the appearance of such cosmic suffering. For example, one has to admit that simply by maintaining our humanity, we have to become debtors to the earth. I cannot give to the earth what I really should give it. Give if, in a cosmic sense, I were to act with complete rectitude. Matters are similar as regards the substance which is present in the head. Because throughout the entire course of earthly life, spiritual forces are working in the physical substance of the head. This head substance becomes estranged from the earth. Man must remove from the earth the substance for his head. But in order to be man, He must also continually imbue this substance of his head with extraterrestrial spiritual forces. And when the human being dies, this is something extremely disturbing to the earth, because it must now take back the substance of the human head, which has become so foreign to it. When the human being has gone through the gate of death and yields up his head substance to the earth, then this head substance, which is now spiritualized and bears within itself what results from the spiritual, does in fact act as a poison, as a really disturbing element in the totality of the life of the earth. When man sees into the truth of these matters, he is obliged to say to himself that the honest thing would be to take this substance with him through the gate of death, for it would in fact be much better suited into the spiritual region which man traverses between death and a new birth. He cannot do this. For if man were to take this spiritualized earth substance with him, he would continually create something adverse to all his development between death and a new birth. It would be the most terrible thing that could happen to man if he were to take this spiritualized head substance with him. It would work incessantly on the negation of his spiritual development between death and rebirth. One must therefore acknowledge, when one sees into the truth of these things, that here too man becomes a debtor to the earth, for something for which he is indebted to the earth, but has made useless for it. This he must continually leave behind. He cannot take it with him. What man should leave for the earth, he takes from it. What man should take with him, what he has made useless for the earth, this he gives over to it with his earthly dust, thus causing the earth immense suffering in the totality of its life, the wholeness of its being. Spiritual vision, it is true, at first leaves a heavy weight on the human soul, something like a tremendous feeling of tragedy. And only when one surveys wider epochs of time, when one beholds the evolution of entire systems, only then is the prospect revealed that in later stages of human evolution, when the earth eventually approaches its end in the Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan stages, man will be able to restore the balance, to annul the debt. Thus, it is not only by going through the experiences of a single life that man fashions karma, but man creates karma, world karma, cosmic karma, just through the fact that he is an earthly human being, an inhabitant of the earth, and draws his substance from the earth. It is then possible to look away from man, to look toward the rest of the natural world, and see how, though man must burden himself with the debt of which I have just told you, balance is nevertheless continually restored by cosmic beings. And here one penetrates into wonderful secrets of existence, into secrets which must be seen in conjunction with each other before they become something from which one can gain a conception of the wisdom of the world. Let us turn our gaze away from man and toward something which has claimed much of our attention during the last few days. Let us turn our gaze to the world of the birds, represented for us by the eagle. We spoke of the eagle as the representative of the bird world, as the creature which had all the characteristics and forces of the bird kingdom. When we consider the eagle, we are in fact considering the function of the bird world as a whole, within the great cosmic scheme of things. In future, therefore, I shall simply speak of, in quotes, the eagle. I have told you how the eagle actually corresponds to the head of man, and how the forces which give rise to thoughts in the human head give rise to the eagle's plumage. So that the sun irradiated, light imbued forces of the air are actually working in the plumage. This is what shimmers in the eagle's plumage, the light irradiated power of the air. Now the eagle, to which many bad qualities may certainly be ascribed, does nevertheless possess, as regards its cosmic existence, the remarkable attribute that every part of it that is created by the sun-irradiated forces of the air remains outside the skin in the configuration of the plumage. What takes place here is, in fact, only to be noticed when the eagle dies. For it is only when the eagle dies that one becomes aware of what a remarkably superficial digestion it has compared to the thoroughgoing digestion of the cow with its process of chewing the cud. The cow is really the animal of digestion, again as representative of many creatures of the animal kingdom. Here digestion is thoroughly performed. The eagle, like all birds, digests in a superficial way, only begins the business of digestion. Digestion plays only a small part in the eagle's whole existence, is merely a subsidiary process, and is treated as such. On the other hand, everything in the eagle which has to do with plumage is formed with enormous care. In the case of some other birds, this is even more so. Such a feather is indeed a wonderful structure. Here we find most strongly in evidence what may be called earthly matter, which the eagle has taken from the earth. This is spiritualized by the forces of the heights, but in such a way that the eagle does not make it its own. For the eagle makes no claim to reincarnation. It need not, therefore, be troubled about what is being brought about in the earthly matter of its plumage through the spiritual forces of the heights. It need not be troubled about how this works on in the spiritual world. Now, when the eagle dies and its feathers fall into decay, as already mentioned, this is also true for all other birds, the spiritualized earthly matter goes out into spirit land and is changed back into spiritual substance. You see, the relationship between our head and the eagle is a strange one. What we cannot do, the eagle can. It can remove from the earth what has been spiritualized in the earth through spiritual forces working on earthly substance. This, too, is why we have such a strange feeling when we observe an eagle in flight. We feel it to be something foreign to the earth, something which has more to do with the heavens than with the earth, although it draws its physical substance from the earth. But how does it do this? It obtains its substance by stealing it from the earth. It is just a robber. One might say that according to what may be called the ordinary, commonplace law of earth existence, no provision was made for the eagle to get anything. It becomes a robber and steals physical matter, as is done in all sorts of ways by the bird kingdom as a whole. But the eagle does restore the balance. It steals the physical matter it needs, but then allows it to be spiritualized by the forces which exist as spiritual forces in the upper regions. And after death it carries off into spirit land the spiritualized earth forces which it had stolen. With the eagle, spiritualized earth matter goes out into spirit land. Now the life of animals also does not come to an intimate end when they die. They have their significance in the universe. A physical eagle in flight is only a symbol of its real being, as it were. That is how it flies as a physical eagle. Oh, but it flies on after death. The spiritualized physical matter of the eagle's nature flies into the far distance in order to unite itself with the spiritual substance of spirit land. You see what wonderful secrets of the universe one comes upon when one enters into the reality of these things. Only then does one really learn why the various animal and other forms exist on earth, They all have their great and immense significance in the whole universe. And now let us go to the other extreme, to something which we have also studied during these days. Let us turn to the cow, so venerated by the Hindus. There we have the opposite extreme. Just as the eagle is very similar to the human head, so is the cow very similar to the human metabolic system. The cow is the animal of digestion. And strange as it sounds, this animal of digestion consists essentially of spiritual substance into which the physical matter consumed is merely integrated and diffused. There in the cow you have the spiritual substance, and physical substance penetrates here everywhere and is absorbed, digested by the spiritual substance. It is in order that this may happen in a really thorough way that the process of digestion is so thorough and comprehensive in the cow. It is really the most thorough digestive process that can be conceived. And in this respect, if I may put it so, the cow is really most thorough in the business of being an animal. It is thoroughly animal, and actually brings animal nature, this animal egoism, this animal egoity, down to earth from the universe, and into the sphere of earth's gravity. No other animal has the same relation between blood weight and the total body weight as the cow. Other animals have either less or more blood than the cow in proportion to the weight of the body. Weight has to do with gravity, and the blood with individual existence, not with the ego, for this is only possessed by man, but with separate individual existence. The blood also makes the animal an animal, the higher animal at least. And we might say that the cow has solved the universal problem of the right relation between the weight of the blood and the weight of the whole body, if one wishes to be as thoroughly animal as possible. You see, it was not for nothing that the ancients called the zodiac, quote, the circle of animal figures, close quote. Footnote in German, Tierkreis, circle of animals, end of footnote. The zodiac is 12-fold. Its totality is divided into 12 separate parts. The forces which emerge from the zodiac in the cosmos take on form and shape in the animals. But the other animals do not conform to the zodiacal proportion so exactly. The cow has a 12th part of her body weight in the weight of her blood. Her blood weight is a 12th part of her body weight. In the donkey, it is only a 23rd part, and in the dog, a 10th part. All the other animals have a different proportion. In the case of man, the blood is 1/13th of the body weight. You see, the cow aims to express the whole of animal nature in terms of weight. To bring something cosmic to expression in the most thorough way possible. A fact I have mentioned repeatedly during these days, namely that the astral body of the cow shows that it actually brings a higher principle to realization in physical matter. This comes to expression in the fact that the cow maintains the division into 12 in her own inner ratio of weights. There you have the cosmic principle in the cow. Everything to do with the cow is of such a nature that the forces of the earth are worked into spiritual substance. In the cow, earth heaviness is obliged to distribute itself according to zodiacal proportion. Earth heaviness must allow a 12th part of itself to be subsumed in individual existence. Everything that the cow possesses by way of spiritual substance forces it to enter into earthly conditions. Thus the cow, lying in the meadow, is in actual fact spiritual substance that takes up earthly matter, absorbs it, and makes it similar to itself. When the cow dies, the spiritual substance which it bears within it can be taken up by the earth, together with its earthly matter, to benefit the life of the whole earth. and man is right to regard the cow as the true beast of sacrifice, for essentially she continually gives to the earth what it needs, without which it could not continue to exist and would harden and dry up. She continually gives spiritual substance to the earth and renews the earth's inner mobility, its inner living quality. When you behold, on the one hand, a meadow with its cattle, and on the other hand the eagle in flight, then you have a remarkable contrast. The eagle, which, when it dies, takes away into the expanses of spirit land the earth matter that has become spiritualized and therefore useless for the earth, and the cow, which, when it dies, gives heavenly matter to the earth for its renewal. The eagle takes from the earth what the earth can no longer use, what must return to spirit land. The cow carries into the earth what the earth continually needs as forces of renewal from spirit land. Here you see something like an upsurge of feelings and perceptions arising from initiation science. People usually believe that one can certainly study this initiation science, but that it results in nothing but concepts and ideas. One fills one's head with ideas about the non-physical world, just as one otherwise fills one's head with ideas about the things of the physical world. But this is not how it is. Penetrating ever further into this initiation science, we reach the point of drawing forth, from the depths of the soul, feelings and perceptions, the existence of which we formerly did not even surmise, but which nevertheless are there unconsciously in every human being. We reach the point of experiencing all existence differently from the way we experienced it before. And so I can describe to you an experience which actually belongs to the living comprehension of spiritual science, of initiation science. It is the experience of having to say to ourselves that if man alone were on the earth, we would, if we recognized his true nature, have to despair of the earth ever receiving what it needed. Spiritualized matter withdrawn and spirit substance bestowed at the right time. We should really have to experience the contrast between human existence and the earth's existence, a feeling that causes great, great pain. For we have to admit that if man is to be rightly man on the earth cannot be rightly earth because of man. Man and earth have need of each other, but man and earth cannot mutually support each other. What the one needs is lost to the other. What the other needs is lost to the first. And we should have no security as regards the life relationship between man and earth, were it not that the surrounding world enables us to say, what the human being is unable to achieve in taking spiritualized earth substance over into spirit land is accomplished by the bird kingdom. And what man is unable to do in giving spiritual substance to the earth is accomplished by the animals which chew the cud, as represented by the cow. In this way the world is rounded into a whole. If we look only at man, uncertainty enters our feelings as regards existence on the earth. If we look at what surrounds man, our feeling of uncertainty is restored. And now you will wonder even less that a religious world conception, which penetrates so deeply into the spiritual as does Hinduism, venerates the cow. For it is the animal which continually spiritualizes the earth, and continually gives to the earth that spiritual substance which it has taken from the cosmos. And we really should allow the following image to become real in our minds. Beneath a grazing herd of cattle, the earth is quickened to joyful, vigorous life, and the elemental spirits down there rejoice because they are assured of their nourishment from the cosmos through the existence of the creatures grazing above them. And we ought to paint a picture of the dancing, rejoicing, airy sphere of the elemental spirits hovering around the eagle. Then we would portray spiritual realities, and the physical would be seen within spiritual realities. We would see the eagle extending outward in his aura, and the rejoicing of the elemental air spirits and fire spirits of the air playing into that aura. We would see that remarkable aura of the cow, which is in such marked contrast to earthly existence because it is entirely cosmic. We would see lively merriment in the senses of the elemental earth spirits, who are here able to perceive what they have lost by being constrained to live out their existence in the darkness of the earth. For these spirits, what appears in the cow is sun. The elemental spirits whose dwelling place is in the earth cannot rejoice in the physical sun, but they can rejoice in the astral bodies of the animals which chew the cud. Yes, my dear friends, there does indeed exist a natural history which is different from that found today in books. What is actually the end result of the natural history found today in books? The sequel to the book by Albert Schweitzer, which I discussed some time ago, has just appeared. You may remember my review of this small volume on the state of modern civilization, which appeared some time back in the Goetheanum. The preface to this sequel is in fact representative of a somewhat sorry chapter of modern thought. In the first small volume, which I also reviewed, there was at least a certain force of argument and the insight to admit what our civilization lacks. The preface to this second volume is a really sorry chapter. For Schweitzer here takes credit to himself for being the first to perceive that fundamentally knowledge alone can provide absolutely nothing, and that ethics and a world conception must be gained from somewhere other than knowledge. Now, in the first place, much has been said about the limits of knowledge, and it is, how shall I put it, a trifle short-sighted to believe that one has been able to speak about the limits of knowledge. This has been done by natural scientists in every possible way. So there is no need to pride oneself on being the first to discover this colossal error. Apart from this, however, it emerges that such an excellent thinker, Schweitzer, for he is an excellent thinker, as his first small volume certainly shows, has reached the conclusion that if we wish to have a world conception, if we wish to have ethics, then we must entirely do without science and knowledge, for these in fact give us nothing. Recognized science and knowledge, as put forward today in books, do not enable us, as Schweitzer says, to discover meaning in the universe. Essentially, if one looks at the world the way these individuals do, one cannot avoid the conclusion that eagles in their flight have no purpose apart from the fact that they can be used in making armorial crests. Cows are useful here on earth because they give milk, and so on. But because man also is regarded only as a physical being, he only has physical usefulness, and all this has no meaning for the world as a whole. If people are unwilling to go further than this, they will certainly not reach the level where the world can be seen to have meaning. We must pass on to what the spiritual, to what initiation science can say to us about the world. Then we shall certainly discover the meaning of the world. Then we shall find this meaning of the world, as we discover wonderful mysteries in all existence. Mysteries such as that which unfolds in connection with the dying eagle and the dying cow, and between them the dying lion, which in its turn holds spiritual substance and physical substance in balance within itself, through the harmony it establishes in the rhythm of breathing and of blood. We shall find that it is the lion whose group soul regulates how many eagles and how many cows are necessary to enable the correct process to take its course in the upward and also in the downward direction, in the way I have described to you. You see, the three animals, eagle, lion, and ox or cow, were created out of a wonderful instinctive knowledge. Their connection with man is one we can sense and feel. For when he sees into the truth of these things, the human being should really admit, "The eagle relieves me of the tasks that I myself cannot fulfill through my head. The cow relieves me of the tasks that I myself cannot fulfill through my metabolism and through my limbs. The lion relieves me of the tasks that I myself cannot fulfill through my rhythmical system. And thus I myself and the three animals are made into a whole in the great cosmic scheme of things." Thus one lives one's way into cosmic relationships. Thus one feels the deep connections in the world and learns to know how wise are the powers which hold sway in the living world, into which man is woven, and which billow and surge around him. You see, in this way we were able to interweave everything that we encountered when we sought to discover man's connection with the three animal forces, which we have spoken about in recent weeks. That's the end of Lecture 3 and the end of Part 1 of this lecture cycle, which was entitled Man's Connection with the Cosmos, the Earth, and the Animal World.